created the nonprofit company MIX, Minnesota Internship Center Building Company, even though that acronym doesn't match. In order to buy a building, we look for buildings that we might purchase. We decided not to, and to lease. Right now, two of our five leases, because we have five sites, two of those leases go to MIX, or between MIX and the landlords, and then the school subleases. Our goal is to eliminate that completely dissolve MIX. It's not useful for us right now because we, in the foreseeable future, we're not going to be buying a building. And so I asked George to come along because he has ours. I'm not in favor or disfavor, but his experience is a very good experience with another school.
Okay. So you do have a building company now, yes. But it was sort of a pass-through where you had a building owner who leased to your building company, and then your building company leased to the charter school, correct?
That's right. The idea was if we bought the large building we're anticipating, that then all of our building business would go that way, leases or purchases. But when the big purchase didn't happen, and instead our largest building, we took a lease, and it's a 10-year lease, then that's not going to happen. We're not going to be in the position to buy a school. So we, the company is, the nonprofit company, building company, doesn't make sense for us in the future. So our intent is to rewrite the leases and then dissolve the nonprofit. But that's not a statement in favor or disfavor of building companies. It's just our particular situation.
Right. A follow-up is that when you... when you did set up those leases, was the lease that the building company established with the building owner passed through, was it a complete wash to the school? Like if you were paying $10 a square foot, if the building company was paying $10 a square foot for a building, for example, was that what the charter school was charged by the building company?
It was $1 a square foot more that the building company charged the landlord, and then that money was used for maintenance and didn't cover the maintenance that, costs that we had, but that was the intent was then in the future if we did the purchase that would be a good way to go. Right now it actually affects us adversely because it hurts our balance, our bottom line for the school. Essentially there's the same amount of money on the table either way, but it's a complicating factor that we don't need.
You don't need a building company anymore, is what
no,
you're saying.
No, we don't need one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Mr. Sand, would you like to give a little background?
Yeah, I forgot to mention I do work at the Minnesota Internship Center now, and I'm a strong advocate of building companies. And I was one of the founders and developers of El Colegio Charter School. And we've been in existence. They've been in existence for 10 years in South Minneapolis. And our original impulse had nothing to do with building companies. Our original impulse was to have a school site that built equity in the community, and we're focused on the Latino community. So and I was kind of crabby too, and I didn't want to pay $200,000 a year to a developer, and not build any ongoing sort of resources for the Latino community. So we tried traditional bank financing first, and because we were a brand new school, they just sort of rolled their eyes. And I, through happenstance, just ran into some investment people who were just starting off developing building companies. Like I said, I think we were about the second one. So we developed our building company in early 1999. And the idea for us was we have the building company, the school is the building company. One thing that I like about building companies is they're solely dedicated to the school. So not like a general developer who's got all these other irons in the fire. The building company is really supporting the particular school it works with. So we developed the building company, and the building company has developed the lease with the school. And our building company was backed by investors the first 3 years. And then we refinance to the Council of Larrasso, which has a big charter school development fund, so we get a better rate that way, too. And the whole idea for us is having destiny in our own hands, and we can develop our building. It's an arts focus, so we needed to build a theater and sort of art rooms and art-making room and things like that. So we really had much more flexibility in the building design through the building company. And then 10 years later, we've refinanced twice, and we've built up a nice sort of reserve fund. And the idea is to have enough of a track record to do bank financing, traditional bank financing, if we need to.
So could you talk about you built up a reserve, if you built up a reserve with the lease aid? No.
The lease aid goes, the lease aid is based on the, you know, the cost of the building. So that what if we can keep our rates low, then we have more of our general ed money to put into the classrooms and to use that for our reserve fund. We don't use lease money for the reserve fund. That's all spent.
Good. Perhaps because you've been in this area, you've been involved with these before, is one of the questions we've had is how lease aid with our very limited resources, how lease aid is just really targeted to the facility costs and what is reasonable. I know that when you have different sorts of contracts with a corporation or a nonprofit, we can argue that it could be a private developer or it could be a nonprofit. What's the difference? But I know that some of us went to TISA on Friday, and they have a holding company and a building corporation and then the charter school. And one of the questions I had was that the school was originally purchased for $1.44 million in 2003. And the entire school is not being used, but right now they're receiving lease aid of close to, I think, $500,000 a year. So, you know, over the course of a couple years, that building's been paid for. Where is the lease aid going? And I did ask them to be here today, but they're not coming. So I just wondered, how might it be that we establish lease aid based on the cost of paying off a building, and after a building is paid off, should lease aid continue at that current amount? It's sort of like a bond.
Right, right.
Do you have any thoughts on that? Because you've done this for a number of years.
Well, our thinking was the less we have to pay in building costs, the more it could go into our educational programming. So the idea, we've always worked on 25-year timelines. So as that, the bonds or the, you know, the loans are paid off after 25 years. And if the rate goes down, you know, just how a mortgage works. So then we can put more money into the educational program. Because as everybody said here, the lease aid doesn't cover all the leases anyway, so then we just have more for the educational programs. And for us, again, it's how do we remain competitive with larger school districts? How do we keep reinvesting in the program and reinvesting in the facilities? And you should probably go visit El Colegio, because it's a really beautiful space now, and they've done a lot of improvements over the last couple of years because we use this mechanism.
So do you think that it's appropriate that maybe this committee should look at, since lease aid is something that has worked well for you, that with all of our public schools right now, a public school has to go to their voters and ask them to approve any significant funding to fix buildings, update buildings, fix leaky windows and roofs, et cetera. Should voters be asked about investing in these kind of things? Or is this how we should be funding all of our public schools?
Oh, that's a good one. Oh, or you could do it as part of, like in Minneapolis and St. Paul, part of the increased levies could go to charter school facilities or something like that. Because, you know, my kids go to St. Paul School, so they're $25 million in the hole. So they're going to ask us for money. And it's mostly it has to do with facilities and things like that. So if you wanted to split up the larger school districts into smaller schools that manage their own finances, then lease aid would be the way to go. And that's, again, the beauty of charter schools is they bring a competitive edge into the education program. And then they're just much better at managing finances than traditional school districts.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you very much. Are there any other questions from members of this committee? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The third The third charter school to come today is St. Croix Preparatory Academy and John Gutierrez. Welcome, Mr. Gutierrez. And St. Croix Preparatory is currently constructing a school, and so it's sort of another model. So you're a new facility, and I know that you have a handout for us. So if...
Correct, Madam Chair.
Yes.
It's good to see you again. And members of the Charter School Working Group. I have the Madam Chair sent me some questions to try and walk through today. So I will use the handout to try and explain how building companies work, where lease aid flows, and those types of things. So I'll walk through that. Any questions along the way, feel free to ask me. I've tried to highlight it with the advantages of how we perceive a building company offering advantages to taxpayers in school construction. Really, and I'll, as I walk through this, I'll highlight this, but I wanted to lead with at least what we see as the advantages and really a lack of exposure for the state in terms of financial obligation and legal obligation. There's no property tax increases, and if the school does close, the state's not on the hook for that particular project. And also, as Mr. Piccolo has already mentioned, the predictable and fixed facilities cost over a course of 30 years. I'll go to the diagram, and I'll try to highlight St. Croix Prep's story in here as well, just to give some flavor as to how we've done this and why we've done this. The school, St. Croix Prep, is a charter school in Stillwater, focuses on academics, character, leadership. We're in our fifth year of existence. We opened with 200 students in 2004. We are currently at 725 students. We have a waiting list of about 400. So our test scores rank among the highest in the state, and parent satisfaction is in the mid-90%, student retention similar. I might add that in our student and parent surveys over the past 3 years, satisfaction regarding facilities ranked under 50% for the past 3 years, so people were not satisfied with our facilities. We formed our building company in 2005, and I might add that because of the Stillwater demographics, we were looking for facilities for about 2 years before we found them, just for our opening in 2004. We wish there was more space in Stillwater, but there's not. And so we knew immediately that our growth pattern would provide facility challenges for us. We approached the school district of Stillwater to see if they had any space to lease. They did not. And so the building company really was formed to give us some flexibility in addressing our facilities issues. Whether it was lease or whether it was purchase, we just wanted to do that because we needed to, just in case we needed to go forward with school construction. That's really the school. As I think we all have heard in another hearing, the lease aid comes to the school, and the school then pays the landlord for the lease of the facility. The building company, as I mentioned, that was formed in 2005. There are the building company is a legally separate nonprofit organization. It really does a few things. One is it obtains approval for the facility site. If you're going to do a purchase and a construction, then it would actually purchase the land, engage with architects and contractors for the school construction, and then do school maintenance. Madam Chair, you asked to discuss the relationship between the building company and the school. There are probably three options as far as board composition. If we were to ask three attorneys, we might get nine other options, but these are the three that we can think of. One is that the building company board would be a subset of the school board. That is one option. The other is that there would be some members of the school board that would be on the building company board. And the third option is that the board composition of the building company would be completely separate from the school board. As this rolls out, right now St. Croix Prep's model is the second, so we fit in the middle of that model. I might add that when you initially set up a building company, a lot of it is bylaws, articles of incorporation, correspondence with the IRS. I could see where option one would be a good starting point because it's you're just waiting time out and communicating with the IRS, getting tax determination letters and so on. But as the school and the building company begin to evaluate facilities options, it's probably necessary to move away from that into the second or the third model.
So just a point on that, and this I think is, you know, is for the as we have sort of looked at building companies, one thing I saw was that charter school boards tend to appoint the members of these nonprofits, and that I think has been something that has sort of been a bit of an issue or a question mark, because we're so clear that charter schools do not own buildings.
Correct.
And yet charter schools are creating these subdivisions. And I'm not saying that's a good or bad thing. It's just that, is that the appropriate way? I think that's where it's been set up that way. But I think that some people were surprised that there was such a close relationship between these two groups. And I just wanted to just point that out, that that was – I think that's how your incorporation – is that how your articles are, is that the board appoints the members of the building company?
Correct, and then okay. It's migrated so that it's right. It has expanded.
Right.
2 points on this that might be helpful, because I definitely understand the concern. There are probably 2 checkpoints in this. One is our friends, the auditors, because they do audit the school and the building company, and they do they evaluate the issues related to internal control, segregation of duties, and conflict of interest. And then while we admire our investment bankers and their 3 legal teams, they ask more questions than auditors, and they go through that process more diligently than the audit side as well. So there's at least 2 checks related to that. The building company, so hopefully, does that address the school, the
it
building
does.
Company?
Thank you very
okay.
much.
Okay. The history of, as Mr. Piccolo has mentioned, really the way to finance a new school construction via a building company is something that's been in existence with other nonprofits, as he mentioned, healthcare, nursing homes. So it really follows this model. And I think the history's already been covered as beginning in 1998. And so St. Croix Prep has just stepped into that model to do that. From a – just want to make sure, Madam Chair, I'm answering your questions. How is the building financed? The building company then engages with an investment bank. And then the investment bank does a public offering. So it's a public offering statement. There's probably a 90 to 120-day due diligence period where the investment people, the financial analysts, and all the attorneys ask and seek information on nearly every document in our possession, everything from all of our board minutes to all of our agreements, licenses, faculty, compensation plans. They even know how much paper we use in our copying machine because they analyze all those agreements. At that point in time, then there is an investor roadshow where investors will see whether they think that this project is beneficial to the investment community that they serve. If they do, then they buy the bonds, and then the proceeds of the public offering goes to the building company, and then the building company then contracts with the architect, the construction company, and then they build the school.
Very good.
On the financial analyst side, I just want to add one.
Maybe just, you know, on that, I know that where is the municipality at? Because are they municipal bonds that are sold, or it may vary?
They're tax-exempt bonds, but every the building company needs a conduit or an organization that can actually issue tax-exempt bonds. So it could be a city, it could be a township, it could be a county. In our case, it's Bay Township.
Okay.
Is the county. The township is not responsible for the bonds, but they just provide the conduit to get it into the market in a tax-exempt status.
I'm not a bond expert. I'm not sure how many of us are at the table. Is there, like, no collateral behind these bonds, or is there anything?
Nope, there's not.
So they're purely that the investors are very confident that that's just fine.
Correct. Well, the investors, I think on one of the pages I said the investors for St. Croix Prep school project issued by the building company. It's Oppenheimer, Federated Investors, Nuveen, and so on.
Okay.
So the I wish I could say that the financial analysts were encouraged by the fact that we were in a school project, but really they were more concerned about the business model and whether their investors would get their money back.
Very good. Thank you.
I think the the final issue is that, or how the lease aid flows. So the lease aid flows from the lease aid application of the school. The building company is, in a sense, the landlord, and then the money then flows from the school to the building company. If the school were to fail, what happens is that, obviously, the school would not get their lease aid. They could not make their lease payment to the building company. The building company would default on their principal and interest payments to the bondholders. So they would go into default. But because the building company is a legally separate organization, the investors would simply lose their investment, and they can't reach through and get to the school or get to the state or get to the taxpayer. So the advantage of this model is that the funding for the building comes from the investors, the funds, the Oppenheimer, Nuveen's, and then that the building is built without impact to the local taxpayer in the terms of property tax. And then there's a predictable cost for the facilities cost over 30 years.
So if I heard you right, that if for some reason there was a default on the bond, that the investors would not be able to claim the school, it would belong to the building company.
Correct.
So if lease aid was impacted and the school was unable to pay its lease, the investors would be left holding.
Correct.
Just wanted to check on that.
So from our perspective, the lease aid is a variable, valuable piece of our funding.
Right. Very good. We're not used to talking a lot about bonds in the education case. I really appreciate your very good discussion of this. Excellent.
What I did as well for information purposes is just indicate some of the common misunderstandings. I don't know that we need to go through that, but you can.
So question from Senator Bonnoff maybe first, and then Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to understand where's the risk for the investor. So it seems to me one risk on the investment side is, you know, we do something with the lease aid. Another risk would be if the real estate value goes down. How does that all figure in?
I think, Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff, I think the risk from an investor perspective is they look at the school, the enrollment. They know that in charter schools and in traditional districts, that revenue is tied to enrollment. So they look at the viability model from that perspective and see, will the school sustain its enrollment? Will it continue on its mission? Will it develop, continue with good test scores or whatever the metric is that they use? I don't know that they evaluate lease aid as much, although the question has been asked, and we have indicated that in previous legislative sessions, lease aid has been grandfathered, and any changes are going forward.
Okay, Madam Chair, and Mr. Gutierrez.
Gutierrez,
thank you. But aren't the investors investing in the building itself?
The investors have actually... with the public offering, now what happens is on August 13th, whenever the day was, the bonds were sold, and the investors bought the bonds. So they would be 6.75% or 7% tax-exempt bonds. The building company received the $21 million of the bond offering, then subsequently purchased the land, engaged all the people to do the construction, and now the building company has to pay for the bonds and the principal and interest that's due on the bonds on a semi-annual basis.
So, Madam Chair?
Senator Olson.
So, Madam Chair, whether it's a state decision on lease aid or for some reason the school stops functioning, does the building company then have the capability of selling the building and paying off the bond? I mean, is there an investment covered in that way?
Yes. I mean,
who does the building belong to and what can they do with it?
Correct. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Senator Olson. That is correct. If the building company went into default, then the investors would own the building. They could take over the building, and then they could sell the building if that was their choice.
So I have a question because this is, we are trying to learn about all this, and I really appreciate you being here to help us. I wonder if Mr. Deans from the School Board Association could give us a quick answer to how do bonds work with a public school district? Is this how it would work with public schools that issue bonds as opposed to the bonds that Mr. Gutierrez is explaining? And I'm sorry, I didn't ask you ahead of time if you'd be willing to answer this question, Mr. Deans.
Chair, my name is Tom Deans, and I'm legal counsel of the School Board Association. Well, when a school district gets authority to issue, let's just take the simplest thing. They go to the voters, they get authority to issue building bonds. Those building bonds are general obligations of the school district. They levy each year a sufficient amount to pay the principal and interest on those bonds. School district owns the building. If the school district, for whatever reason, the property tax payments or whatever don't come in or they go into default, then it kicks into the credit enhancement program, and then there's a levy to pay that off that also triggers the general obligation of the school district. But the bonds will always be paid. The full faith and credit of the school district is behind the bonds. That levy will be made in an amount sufficient to pay the bonds.
And what kind of interest rates do you is there a difference in interest rates or between these
revenue bonds?
Right, the revenue bonds.
These are really revenue bonds,
okay,
that they're doing.
Versus general obligation
bonds. I serve as bond counsel on a lot of deals, but I'm not a fiscal consultant. But I think normally the spread is about 200 basis points between a revenue bond and a GO. Because school districts do occasionally are involved in some revenue bond type financing too when they're doing lease type financings, where someone will issue revenue bonds and then we'll have a lease with them to pay it. But that's a non-appropriation lease. So it's usually around 200 basis points. But the risk in their situation is really on the purchaser. It's on the bondholders. You get a higher rate of return, but you have that risk that the thing is going to go belly up. In theory, it goes belly up, and you can sell that school and hopefully be able to cover the outstanding principal on your bonds. There's a number of things that can happen. You can't sell the school. You know, you got to remember, schools are, in most cases, not all cases, but in most cases, schools are zoned residential. And you can only do so much with that school when it comes time to sell it. They won't let you put a business or a video store or whatever there. You got a school and it's in the middle of somebody's neighborhood and you're zoned out from doing a lot of other things with that school. So that's one of the risks. They may not be able to sell that school. In the event that they can't, you know, they hold on to it, but the bondholders just take the beating. They lose the thing. If eventually they can sell it, maybe they get their share back. You know, because there might be another buyer. Maybe there's a Catholic school that comes in wants to buy it, or a private school, or somebody wants to buy it, or maybe the school district wants to buy it. But whatever, I mean, but the risk is on those bondholders, and that's why they get the higher interest rate.
Okay. So questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Deans.
Okay. I can speak to some of those other issues that you've been doing at a different time, if you'd like.
Very good.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Gutierrez, anything else you'd like to add? I know you have a few other points here.
Right. I'll let you read those. I'll just highlight a couple of them. There actually is a public approval process. There's a couple different things on the public approval process. I think I'm correct in stating that no matter which district or school is trying to build a school, that the land site will always come under public approval because it has to go through the Planning Commission, city, traffic studies, environmental studies, and so on. For the issuance of the debt, the columns related to Minneapolis-St. Paul and 20 other districts, this comes from the Minnesota Department of Education. They indicate that there are about 20 to 24 districts that do not have to receive public approval to issue the debt. They have some pre-existing conditions already. Sancor Prep doesn't have to receive public approval for the debt because the debt is not being paid by the public. It's being absorbed by the bondholders. And doesn't impact property taxes and so on, as we've discussed.
Very good. Okay. Senator Bonoff.
Madam Chair, Mr. Dean's comment about the higher interest rate, that is something I think we should also consider, because if our tax dollars are going in the form of lease aid and the lease aid is at a higher interest rate, then are we wisest in how we're spending taxpayer dollars? Is that a model that makes sense?
And that's, I think, why it's important to start for us to sort of understand this process of how, again, how are we being most efficient, and that would be really, really helpful. And, I think that there's a discussion of, since lease aid isn't property tax dollars, that it's okay, and, to us, it's public dollars. So trying to determine that if it's general fund dollars that we're spending, those are dollars that could be going to the formula or could be going to other kind of programs that are also very important to us, that we're competing, in a local community, property tax dollars are, competing with other things. To us, lease aid dollars here are competing with other programs that we're really struggling to try to figure out how to fund in this coming year. So that's, I think, a good discussion, Senator Bonoff. We'll have to perhaps talk with Mr. Deans and others on if there's a better way to do that. Just, I guess, another a follow-up I've asked the others is, would it be helpful to have some sort of advance approval process? Because, I think especially with, St. Croix Prep and building a fairly significant size school, and while there's been, the Planning Commission and city and county, school districts have a different approval process of going to their voters and going to their general community for this. And how would that be helpful, and what would you suggest, Mr. Gutierrez, that would is there something you think might be appropriate that would be reasonable to ask of charter schools? So that, because right now you're coming to the state and it hasn't been approved yet. What would be a reasonable process?
I think, Madam Chair, my first thought is if the public would get to vote on the approval, then I'd like the public to join in on the funding.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be the first thing that I'd say. I think it's a complicated question, and I really don't have a good answer for it. The only thing I can say is that, at least in our situation, our school receives about 70% of the funding of our resident district. And so we feel that we're doing a great job in our education program and finding facilities on funding that's significantly less. And so we don't know why we should be penalized for that. But I do understand, because of the sentiments of charter schools and some of the perceptions, I think it's important that they work together with the communities that they're in so that everybody sees them as a community asset and a choice in education that parents can freely choose to attend.
Absolutely. I think that also on the funding for charter schools, one of the things I think everyone at this table has really worked on is wanting a stronger basic formula, that the reliance on a levy may work in some school districts, but it does impact charter schools. I know I have some other folks here from my district, and I've talked a little bit about a stronger formula helps everybody, and I think we tried to do this past year with putting dollars on the formula. And I think that 70% difference, one of the things that we're also aware of is that our district schools receive special education funding, and charter schools are able to pass on some of those additional costs to our district schools, who are not getting reimbursed from them. So the cross subsidy that is being taken out of general ed to fund special ed costs, not just for kids in their district, but kids who may be in charter schools, is something to think about. So I just think that we need to acknowledge that. So one more thing I just wanted to ask is that I know with this advanced approval that would be really important is that one of the things we've talked about is like environmental issues. And I know you've addressed the whole issue with the water quality issue and filtered water. And in a PCA report and EPA report that was issued, it does mention that buildings both existing and potential in this area, there is a potential risk for vapor intrusion. And are you addressing that, or is there a way that you're going to be able to address that in getting the lease date approved?
Sure. Madam Chair, actually, there is no vapor intrusion issue. In our school and on our board, we have environmental engineers with 20 years of experience. And the first question, imagine the investors, and I will say this because this is what exactly happened, is we walk into a group of financial analysts, and the first question they ask is, they said, you're building a school, can we see the environmental reports? Because our investors will not put a penny in if there are any environmental issues. So what we've done is, with the environmental studies, those were submitted to the investors. The investors looked at them. Our own environmental engineers examined them as well, and the investors determined that there was no issue with environmental risk.
So I'm looking at a report of March 28, 2007, again from the MPCA and the EPA, and it clearly says its basis for taking action, hazardous substances that have been detected in each medium include, number two, soil and gas vapor. Although it has not been observed, the potential exists for soil vapor intrusion into buildings either existing or planned located on the plume. So is there any remediation that's been included with this?
The school will receive all of its utilities from Bayport. And so Bayport has a remediation system in place. So we have city utilities. The last test performed by the city of Bayport showed zero parts per whatever billion. So there's no environmental risk.
Okay, very good. Any other questions for Mr. Gutierrez?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Gutierrez. In
Mr. Wieger.
2006 or 5, when you were denied a few times to get a lease with the school district, was there space available in your eyes?
We thought that there may be space available in one of the schools, but that's why we made the inquiry. They sent some correspondence back saying they did not have lease space available. So,
Madam Chair, I'm curious. You mentioned legislation earlier, and had we had the requirement an offer be would have to be considered a right of refusal if a charter school wanted to do a lease with the public school. And I'm just curious, had this been in effect earlier, then this would have required it. But I assume it's up to debate. But well, I'd like to get a little more perspective on.
Right. And, you know, I really want this bill to come out so that we can have a discussion on that. I think that in this particular case, in the Stillwater District, there was not a school building that was empty. That maybe overall, if you added up, if we redistrict, reboundaried, maybe you could, close Marine School, which would not go over very
Correct.
Well in our district.
Correct.
But I think that that's one of the issues is that, and I think that, you know, Dr. Kite has brought that up when we had one of our first hearings. He said that the public doesn't understand why in some communities we're closing schools because of just demographics, and then a new school is being constructed, and the public says, well, where did this money come from? And I think that's one of the issues to look at is with demographics in some districts, if a district is going to lease a building, that it should be offered first to a charter school. That, I believe, is how the bill is written. So if a district, it's not that they would have to, but I think it's just some good discussion.
Right.
And there's also a bill that I've introduced that really addresses how do we work with our traditional district schools to help them be able to do some of these innovative things that we're encouraging within charter school. How do we give them the flexibility so it's not that only charter schools can say we've got the ability to do all these, you know, innovative things, but then we tie the hands of our school districts. And how do we really transfer that? I think with, Math and Science Academy is an example of here's a model that is very different from what may be happening within our public schools. How are we transferring that back if there's excitement and interest in that within our public schools? So just some general comments. Senator Wieger?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And a follow-up, you move in this summer,
yes,
early fall?
In August.
And you have a waiting list, I believe you said, of over 300?
Yep, I think our waiting list now is back up to over 400 students.
So you need a lot of additional square footage?
No, the building is being built for a full capacity of near 1,000 students. And so when we have about 725 students now, with our incoming kindergarten classes and so on, we'll be in the 800 student range. The way the bonds work is the bond payments are staggered, so we don't have to pay for the 1,000 students right out of the chute.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, there was reference in the handout about two of the board members are members of the school board. That's your school board.
Yes, that's correct.
Could you characterize the relationship with the Stillwater School District?
Senator Wieger, I could. And I think maybe Senator Saltzman and Madam Chair could as well. From our perspective, I think it depends on who you're speaking with. It's cordial. I know I have good relationships with some board members and administration. I know that at times as well that there's some friction and tension because of students do mean dollars. And so the success of St. Croix Prep, I know sometimes causes some irritation, and we recognize that. Our perspective is, and we have students that leave St. Croix Prep to go to a high school, a more full high school experience, because when they're with the same 25 kids for 4 years, they want some other friendships. And what we say is that we just want what's best for the kids, where they succeed, where they're happy, where they can have the high school experience that they want. So that's what we firmly believe, and we just want to be a choice that other people can choose if they feel that the mission fits with their desires.
Very good. And I guess that I have not been involved in those relationships between the school board, but I do know that the district has tried to work with the school, I think, on sports programs.
Right.
That there's been some board members who have encouraged that. And then also we try to, I guess, balance between it's not one school is better than the other. It's
right.
It's both. Charter schools and district schools provide a lot of options to students. And Stillwater Schools has, I believe, a very unique policy of choice that all of their elementary schools are open so that students can choose an element. Now, they don't get bused,
right.
But they are able to choose an alternative school, which I think has been a good situation.
Correct. And what we found is also part of it is our education process. So sometimes if there's difficulty with the athletic programs, it's really not Stillwater's decision, it's the Minnesota State High School League decision or the conference decision. So I think on both sides, I know maybe there's some sentiments about our school and how it got built without public approval. Part of this is just the education process of this is how things work, these are how approval processes work, much like the conversation we're having now to discuss how do building companies mm-hmm. work and lease aid flow.
Very good. Any other questions? Well, thank you, Mr. Gutierrez, very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee.
Before we adjourn, I just wanted to review with people that we probably will have another meeting in probably a couple weeks. And I just wondered if there was interest in from committee members, those who are here, Senator Wieger and Senator Olson, on specific topic areas that you believe that you'd like to hear a little bit more testimony on before we start really digging into some of these bills as background.
You're covering it quite well.
Senator Wieger. Well, Madam Chair, we did have discussion on the purpose of charter schools. We heard from the pioneers, and we also had discussion about the de facto segregation.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk about integration aid this session, and I think it would be helpful to talk about the potential of mixed use of dollars for public dollars, looking at providing integrated opportunities in the public schools, and at the same time providing important choices but resulting in a segregated school. And I think it would be helpful as we go into our continued discussions on the budget. But I've been asked this by several people I've met and been very impressed by the passion of many of the parents, staff that are involved at schools that would be deemed, you know, racially segregated. But you know, the question I think, you know, that Myron Orfield and others raised, I think, needs some additional discussion. Is this a, you know, when we look at the principles and what was intended, and I would like to have a little more discussion on that.
And that, I think, is something that I was hoping that we might be able to explore, that there has been some discussion in this committee about segregation. There's been some issues of religion. There's also been some issues about special education and some schools that have really targeted specific groups of children who have specific disabilities. And then there's also been some concerns raised from parents that charter schools are not providing the kind of special education that their children would like. So I think for us to have the discussion and just hear some of these issues, it might be helpful for us in moving forward with policies that not just impact charter schools, but some of our other issues as well. So that will be, I think, a very respectful conversation, because I think we want to hear both sides of these issues. And it's about serving children well, but it's also about this committee feeling very comfortable with the direction of how schools are being developed. So I think if we can do that and learn from people who might have different perspectives, that would be very helpful. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to, again, state that I'm not opposed, you know, to the great accomplishments that have been made by, you know, many of the charter schools that are primarily segregated. But it does raise a question, and I'd like us to discuss that a little bit more. We have put a great deal of effort into how do we close the achievement gap? How do we bring up more opportunities for everyone? And when many people of color have said, we want this choice, and parents are asking that we continue with that, we need to be sensitive, but I believe it does send two distinct messages, and I want to see how we reconcile that, if we in fact should.
Very much. That's an excellent point. Well, at this point, I'm going to adjourn the meeting. We will call another meeting. If we'll be around if people have specific questions for us. I think that as these proposals come out, I hope that people will look at them and that we are all trying to find common ground on all these issues. And I think that if we can work together with all the different stakeholder groups, that I think that we're going to come up with an excellent package that I really think it's time to review charter schools. We have been a leader in the country, and I think that people will be looking to what we're doing. We hear many of these same issues are being debated in other states, so let's be a leader in making sure that our laws strengthen the charter school movement and that we continue to be leaders in Minnesota. So with that, meeting adjourned. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kathy, are you coming to 622 tomorrow?
Am I supposed to be going to 622?
It's at 7:00 a.m.
To meet with the board.